Austin that he's in, is it? From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Our system failed in basic fundamental ways. Compensation practices rewarded short-term profits over long-term return. Pervasive failures in consumer protection left many Americans with obligations they did not understand and could not sustain.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner outlines plans to rewrite the nation's financial rules. We'll speak with economist James Galbraith. His latest article, No Return to Normal, why the economic crisis and its solution are bigger than you think. Then we take a look at the struggle in Guadeloupe, where labor has won a six-week general strike. The victory is being felt from the French Caribbean to France. Then the death of newspapers.
As local papers are closing, we're losing a valuable tradition in America, critically important to our communities, critically important to our democracy.
Maryland Senator Benjamin Cardin introduces the Newspaper Revitalization Act. We'll speak with Free Press co-founder Bob McChesney about the death and life of great American newspapers. And tomorrow marks the 30th anniversary of Three Mile Island, the worst nuclear accident in U.S. history. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Obama administration's unveiled plans to boost government regulation over the financial system. On Thursday, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner outlined proposals including expanding federal oversight for the first time to cover financial derivatives trading, large hedge funds, and insurers such as AIG. Regulators would also impose uniform standards to limit the range of functions of major financial firms, including banks. Speaking before the House Financial Services Committee, Geithner said the changes were prompted by the failure of the economic system to regulate excess and greed.
Our system failed in basic fundamental ways. Compensation practices rewarded short-term profits over long-term return. Pervasive failures in consumer protection left many Americans with obligations they did not understand and could not sustain. The huge apparent returns to financial activity attracted fraud on a dramatic scale. Market discipline failed to constrain dangerous levels of risk-taking throughout the system.
The new rules come on top of previously announced proposals for government authority to seize troubled non-banking financial firms. President Obama is expected to promote the plan in meetings with top Wall Street bankers later today. We'll have more on this story after headlines with James Galbraith. The insurance giant AIG is facing new congressional and legal scrutiny over how it funneled tens of billions of dollars in taxpayer bailout money to banks facing huge losses that AIG had insured. In what some have called the backdoor bailout, AIG gave nearly $13 billion to Goldman Sachs and tens of billions more to other firms, including Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, and several foreign banks. On Thursday, 26 House Democrats signed a letter by Congressmember Elijah Cummings asking the bailout program's Inspector General to investigate the payments. Meanwhile, New York State Attorney General Andrew Cuomo subpoenaed AIG for information related to the derivatives payments funneled to the banks. President Obama is expected to unveil today a major expansion of U.S. military efforts in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Following a two-month review, Obama will reportedly order an additional 4,000 troops to Afghanistan on top of the 17,000 new combat troops authorized last month. The Washington Post reports Obama's plan will require a 60% increase to the $2 billion in monthly U.S. military costs in Afghanistan. Administration officials also say they'll impose new benchmarks on their allies in the Afghan and Pakistani governments. The plan will also reportedly include reconciliation efforts aimed at low-level Taliban fighters while shunning top leaders. On Thursday, National Intelligence Director Dennis Blair estimated some two-thirds of pro-Taliban groups are motivated by basic concerns such as inadequate water supplies or access to education. Meanwhile, in Pakistan, at least 48 people were killed, dozens more wounded in a suicide attack on a mosque earlier today. The bombing came in the town of Jamrud near Pakistan's border with Afghanistan. In Iraq, 16 people were killed, another 45 wounded Thursday in a car bombing in northeast Baghdad. It was the fifth major bombing attack to hit Iraq this month. U.S. officials have confirmed Israel was behind a deadly airstrike that killed dozens of people in Sudan this past January. The U.S. says Israel attacked a convoy of 17 trucks suspected of carrying weapons intended for smuggling into the Gaza Strip. Estimates of the death toll range from 39 to more than 100. In Israel, outgoing Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert declined to comment on the specific attack, but said Israel can operate near and far.
We are taking action wherever we can strike terror infrastructure, in places that are nearby and not that close. We are hitting them, and in a way that strengthens deterrence and the image of deterrence.
U.S. officials say they believe the alleged weapons could have come from Iran, but haven't offered evidence. Meanwhile, in the Gaza Strip, senior Hamas official Osama al-Mozaini denied receiving outside weaponry.
Hamas does not receive weapons from any country or any other side. To have convoys driving weapons to Hamas is a false statement and comes under the mockery and censorship which Israel always tries to execute. We affirm that Hamas has their own means, which are far from the official and international means, to get weapons.
Supporters of Palestinian rights have long criticized Israeli and U.S. indignation at Palestinian efforts to arm themselves when most of Israel's military arsenal is funded and supplied by the United States. The Israeli government's released an investigation downplaying the number of civilian deaths in its attack on the Gaza Strip. On Thursday, the Israeli military gave a death toll of 1,166 and said most of the dead were combatants. In Gaza, Khalil Abu Shmal of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights dismissed the Israeli claims.
All the international human rights organizations emphasized that Israel committed war crimes against the Palestinians. Israel will try to deceive the people, will try to deceive the international public opinion in order to show that they did not kill this huge number of the civilians during the last aggression on the Gaza Strip.
Palestinians say Israel killed more than 1,400 people, most of them civilian. A top UN official says the global economic crisis has pushed the number of chronically hungry people past the 1 billion mark for the first time. Food and Agriculture Organization head Jacques Diouf disclosed the figure to the Financial Times. Last year, the FAO estimated about 960 million people were chronically hungry worldwide. President Obama fielded questions from internet users nationwide Thursday in the White House's first ever online town hall. Obama said he expects more job losses during the current recession.
We're going to have to be patient and persistent about job creation because I don't think that we've lost all the jobs we're going to lose in this recession. We're still going to be in a difficult time for much of this year.
The questions were selected following an online vote. The most popular question asked Obama to comment on whether he thinks legalizing marijuana could help boost the economy. Obama answered no, but didn't rule out legalization outright. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs, however, later said Obama opposes legalization. In North Dakota, the town of Fargo is bracing for a potential major flood as the Red River continues to rise. The river currently stands at nearly 40 feet, with predictions it could hit 43 feet by Saturday. Hundreds of volunteers have turned out to help sandbag dikes around the city, which are now as high as 43 feet. Evacuations have already taken place in nearby towns hit by flooding and frozen temperatures. In Pennsylvania, the state Supreme Court has overturned hundreds of juvenile convictions handed down by two corrupt judges who took bribes in return for placing the youths in privately owned jails. Judges Mark Civarella and Michael Conahan are said to have received $2.6 million for ensuring that juvenile suspects were sent to private prisons. Some of the young people were jailed over the objections of their probation officers. The judges pled guilty to fraud last month and face up to 7 years in prison. On Thursday, the Pennsylvania court ruled Civarella violated the constitutional rights of youth suspects in his courtroom from 2003 to 2008. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to hear two young people describe what it meant to be imprisoned by Civarella. New figures show the economic downturn has led to an increase in two in defaults on student loans. The U.S. Department of Education says the student loan default rate last year rose to 6.9% from 5.2% a year earlier. An estimated $500 billion in federal student loan debt is now outstanding. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont has introduced a measure to establish a single-payer health care system. The American Health Security Act of 2009 would establish a single government program to guarantee health care to all Americans, including the 46 million currently uninsured. Advocates say the proposal would save some $400 billion by eliminating the bureaucratic costs of the current privately run system. The measure is similar to bills introduced by Democratic Congress members Jim McDermott of Washington and John Conyers of Michigan in the House. You can go to our interview with Independent Senator Bernie Sanders from yesterday at our website, democracynow.org. In other health care news, a new study shows nearly 1 in 5 U.S. workers are uninsured. The figure marks an increase over the mid-90s when fewer than 1 in 7 workers were uninsured. That translates to around 6 million more uninsured workers over the last decade. The House has approved what's being called the biggest expansion of wilderness protection in 15 years. The bill would extend federal protection to 2 million acres across 9 states and launch a river restoration program in western states. The Senate passed its version of the measure last week. With his expected signature, President Obama will make the bill the first major conservation effort of his presidency. Virginia Senator Jim Webb is calling for a comprehensive review of the nation's criminal justice system to reduce the growing prison population. Under the proposal, a blue ribbon panel would conduct a more than year-long investigation and propose reforms on issues including law enforcement, court sentencing, reintegrating prisoners. The proposed commission would also tackle gang violence, drug policy, mental illness, and prison administration. And in Canada, a U.S. war resister has been granted a last-minute stay of deportation. The Canadian federal court says Kimberly Rivera will be allowed to remain in Canada pending a review of her deportation order. Rivera fled the U.S. in January of 2007, along with her husband and 2 children, to avoid returning to Iraq. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner outlined plans Thursday to rewrite the nation's financial rules as part of what the Wall Street Journal described as the most comprehensive changes to financial market regulation since the New Deal. Geithner's plan includes the creation of a single regulator to monitor any firm whose failure could threaten the financial system.
Our system failed in basic fundamental ways. Compensation practices rewarded short-term profits over long-term return. Pervasive failures in consumer protection left many Americans with obligations they did not understand and could not sustain. The huge apparent returns to financial activity attracted fraud on a dramatic scale. Market discipline failed to constrain dangerous levels of risk-taking throughout the system. New financial products were created to meet demand from investors, but the complexity outmatched the risk management capabilities of even the most sophisticated institutions in the world. To address this will require comprehensive reform, not modest repairs at the margin, but new rules of the game. And the new rules must be simpler and more effectively enforced. They must produce a more stable system, one that protects consumers and investors, rewards innovation, and is able to adapt and evolve with changes in the structure of our financial system.
Treasury Secretary Geithner also called for extending federal regulation for the first time to all trading in financial derivatives and credit default swaps that are blamed for much of the economic crisis. Under his plan, the government would also be empowered to take over major non-bank financial firms such as insurers and hedge funds if deemed necessary.
Geithner's call for new regulations on Wall Street comes just days after he introduced a controversial proposal for the government to form public-private partnerships to take troubled assets off the books of banks. To talk about these stories, the economist and writer James Galbraith joins us from Austin, Texas. He's professor of public affairs and government at the University of Texas. His most recent book is The Predator State: How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. His latest article, No Return to Normal, appears in the current issue of the Washington Monthly. You are concerned about Tim Geithner's plans over the last few days. Lay out your concerns, Professor Galbraith.
Public-private partners.
Well, if you can possibly bear with yourself hearing, with you hearing yourself reverberating in your ear, we're not hearing that echo.
For transferring the risk that the underlying assets will go bad from the banks themselves by getting them off their books, largely to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which would offer a non-recourse loan for about 85% of the value of the assets that are being purchased. And the difficulty I have with that is that I think that plan is based upon an excessively optimistic assessment of the prospects for those assets. And what Secretary Geithner said yesterday, that these assets were issued to consumers that in many cases did not understand what they were getting into, and that they were magnets for fraud, both of those remarks are absolutely true. But once one, I think, takes that into account effectively, you realize that the prospects for capital losses on those assets are really very, very high. The recovery rates are likely to be quite poor, and that we've already seen that with the banks that the FDIC has taken over, specifically with NDMAC in California. And so that suggests to me that this is a this plan would have the effect of transferring the losses to the taxpayers without exacting any serious consequences for the banks that essentially created the fiasco. And since the financial system has to shrink one way or another, if you protect the largest banks, as I think the Treasury plan does, then the consequences will fall on other financial institutions, which are relatively well managed and which did not take part in the to the same degree in the subprime debacle, and those will tend to be smaller banks. And I think it's really, it's likely to be promote an unmanageable banking structure if we go that route. And secondly, it's not going to solve the problem which everybody would like to see solved, which is the complete breakdown of the credit system. It's not going to bring the economy back to life by the vehicle of new bank spending.
Well, in your article, No Return to Normal, you make the point that it appears that the Obama administration is still dealing with this primarily as a crisis of flow in credit and not a crisis of the actual collapse of the financial system. And could you explain precisely in what way they are missing that fundamental point?
Well, we hear this expression that credit flows are blocked and that there is a need to get credit flowing again. And it really is, it's a metaphor. And I think it's a revealing metaphor if it in fact reflects the way in which high officials of the government are thinking about the problem. The idea of a flow, of course, is something that comes from on high and goes down below. A blockage is a kind of plumbing problem. the difficulty is credit isn't like that. Credit is a bilateral contract. It's a relationship between a lender and a borrower. And the problem is not that the lenders don't have money to lend. The problem is, in very large part, that there are no prospects or very few prospects for profit in the economy, and therefore borrowers, business borrowers, aren't coming in to ask for loans for economic expansion. And secondly, on the residential and household side, households are strapped. They're desperate to hang on to the cash that they have. They're trying to pay down their debts, not to get into new debts. For that reason, they've stopped buying cars and stopped buying houses for the time being. And then even if they did want to come in many cases, they don't have the collateral that they had last year or the year before because the value of their houses has fallen. So those are the problems of the underlying economy. The consequences, to be sure, of the collapse of the housing, of the subprime housing bubble, but they're not problems that can be solved by simply adding new reserves, new capital to the banks. And in fact, we've seen that the banks are flush with cash. They're largely sitting on it. And to the extent that they're not sitting on it, they may be using it for things like acquisitions of other banks, for instance. So the effect of the program is actually to expand the market share and the market power of the largest institutions. And again, to me, that is deeply problematic because we've got banking institutions that are so large at this point, they're so complicated, so opaque, so deeply involved in offshore tax havens, shell corporations, and complicated derivatives, that they can't be managed, let alone regulated. The top executive officers didn't know, to a very large extent, or at least by their own testimony, they didn't know the risk exposure of their own institutions. And they made catastrophic mistakes on the scale of tens and scores of billions of dollars because they didn't have effective internal controls. And if you don't have the internal controls, there's just no way that an outside regulator can get a grip on the systemic risk that the institution may be causing. So my view is, if you want to have a system that has appropriate checks and balances, the institutions in that system have to be of a scale such that the regulators, which Secretary Geithner properly said yesterday, must be strengthened, but they also have to have the basic capacity to deal with the institutions that they're regulating.
In his column in today's New York Times, Paul Krugman raises a similar points, but I guess from a different perspective. He raises the question that the administration is attempting basically to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, to restore this process of securitization that became so prevalent among banks, securitizing mortgages and auto loans and credit card debt. And he says that they're not confronting the fact that that method that has reigned now in banking for decades now has collapsed and is a failure and something else must be done. Do you agree with that?
Well, I would take a modest exception to it by way of going a bit further. It is not the case that the securitization of subprime mortgages is a long-term phenomenon. It is something which has been a practice, prevalent practice, for about 8 years at the maximum. Before that, the markets would not have contemplated the massive securitization of loans which are subprime. What does the subprime mean? Subprime means loans that do not meet the standards for a normal mortgage loan that could be taken up by the secondary markets, by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And so those loans are characteristically loans that don't have documentation, that don't have proper credit histories on the borrowers, and where the appraisals seem a little funny. And in the case of the subprime loans in the middle of the decade, there was systematic fraud in the appraisals, systematic overstatement of what the houses were worth, because the bigger the loan that you gave, the bigger fee you could book. And so These are markets that should never, historically didn't exist, and should not have been allowed to develop. They're intrinsically unsafe. And so from that point of view, Paul, of course, is exactly right that the trying to restore these markets, trying to go back to the normal of 2 years ago, is really trying to go back to a situation that is historically abnormal and intrinsically unstable. And in some ways, you can say what the Treasury plan actually is a way of creating a new derivative, a new bond, if you like, which the Treasury has half the capital and provides 85% of the value of the purchase in the form of a low-interest, non-recourse loan that's designed to make the purchase of these so-called assets from the banks a highly profitable proposition for hedge funds and private equity investors and others who are in a position to risk their capital without having to face fiduciary consequences. And so it's something which I suppose there may be investors out there who think that they could make money off of this, but I'll tell you who it would be particularly attractive to if they could get away with it, and that is the banks themselves or their or people acting on their behalf, because what it would mean is that in effect the banks can transfer someone acting on behalf of a bank could arrange for the transfer of a dollar's worth of these bad securities at face value for 7.5 cents of risk. And that means that you're really, in effect, creating a conduit which would just take these losses off of the books of the banks, put them on the books of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and I would say that would solve the problem for the banks, but it wouldn't solve the problem for anybody else.
Professor Galbraith, we want to thank you very much for being with us. James Galbraith is an economist, professor of public affairs and government at the University of Texas, Austin. His most recent book is The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to talk about what happened in Guadeloupe. Then it is the 30th anniversary of Three Mile Island. We'll be talking about the biggest nuclear accident in U.S. history. And what about the death of American newspapers? Bob McChesney will join us from Madison, Wisconsin. Stay with us.
You better forget about it.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting close to 800 stations on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community stations on NPR stations and Pacifica stations, public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish for any radio station to take, as over 200 are. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Well, the financial crisis has had reverberations far beyond the United States and Europe, with people taking to the streets and cities across the globe to protest rising wealth inequality and to call for economic and labor rights. Perhaps the most significant action took place in the French Caribbean on the island of Guadeloupe. French labor leaders in Guadeloupe led a 44-day general strike that completely paralyzed the island. Starting on January 19th, workers revolted against the French government over the exorbitant cost of living by closing down roads, schools, gas stations, and public transportation. The strike was led by a coalition of union leaders called the LKP, an acronym in Creole that translates to the League Against Profiteering. They accused the ruling white business minority of exploiting the island's black majority. While legally a full part of France and the European Union, Guadeloupe is one of the poorest parts of the national territory, with 23% unemployment and a high cost of living.
The strike has been described as the most significant in the island's history. The six-week struggle saw one activist shot dead, hundreds of extra police deployed from mainland France. The strikers held out and claimed victory earlier this month with a detailed plan to improve wages and living standards on the island. Meanwhile, in the nearby island of Martinique, a similar strike ended 2 weeks later after officials signed an agreement that included salary increases for low-wage earners. For more on all of this, we're joined by Kali Akun. He is the national organizer for the Malcolm X grassroots movement and organizer with the U.S. Solidarity effort with the struggle for the workers and people of Guadeloupe. He is joining us via video stream from New Orleans. Kali, welcome to Democracy Now! Explain to us exactly what this struggle in Guadeloupe was about.
Good morning. The struggle was about the fundamental human rights of the people of Guadeloupe. The cost of living in Guadeloupe had been rising exponentially since kind of escalation of the crisis, particularly around food prices and rents went up beginning in 2007. And particularly the UGTG, the General Union of Workers in Guadeloupe had been raising and agitating the government of Guadeloupe in France since 2007 to kind of increase the wages and ameliorate the living conditions of the people in Guadeloupe. That led to, in December of 2008, the first strike which happened, which preceded the general strike, which commenced in January and ended in March 5th in the great victory of the people of Guadeloupe. And I think, as you mentioned, set a firm tone of struggle, I think, for international, you know, for people all over the world and workers all over the world. But the conditions of unemployment, the conditions particularly of the youth of unemployment, the exclusion primarily of the majority of people from ownership in the island was a major concern, and it's not over. Even though there was an agreement on March 5th, many of the so-called employers association on the island are still refusing to pay the 100 euros that are part of the settlement demand. And so there's still aspects of the strike which are ongoing. And of course, there's a defense of Emil, who was one of the leaders of the strike. He's been charged with a racial kind of defamation charge in France. But this is really an attack to kind of undermine the moral and legitimate basis of the strike itself and undermine the agreement which France and the authorities of Guadeloupe are very insistent on doing, primarily to keep it from spreading. It also spread to Réunion, and it's now starting to have some blowback into France. So it's an issue, which is still kind of part of the ongoing process.
Yeah, Kali Akun, I'd like to ask you about that precisely, because this was a massive movement here that lasted for more than a month. It got virtually no press coverage here in the United States, but it mm-hmm. did have an enormous impact in the Caribbean. What kind of impact did it have within France itself?
Well, I mean, there was a general strike in France, a one-day general strike in France here recently. That put some tremendous pressure on Sarkozy and his government to transform and to deal with this crisis a bit different than how they've been dealing with it thus far in terms of agreeing with the basic settlement aspects of the EU plan, which is going to be discussed at the G20 summit in London. But major sectors that came out, and over 3 million people came out in the general strike, major sectors are now pressing that we need the same basic kind of rights and concessions that were granted from the French government in Martinique and in Guadeloupe. Those need to be applied also in France. And so there are a section of French workers who are organizing now, to my understanding, to launch a general strike and to launch it on the example of what took place in Guadeloupe and stay out in the streets and disrupt business and disrupt the regular order of business, the exploitation on a day-to-day level, to extend that to France. So this is something that myself and I know a lot of folks here who gave some solidarity to the struggle in Guadeloupe are really paying some close attention to, because it's going to have a long-term impact on what happens in the Caribbean possession of France, Martinique, and Guadeloupe, and some of the other so-called overseas possessions, which are still basically colonies. So we're looking at this very closely. Then the impact it's going to have, you know, on workers in Europe and ultimately here in the United States and throughout the world, we think could be pretty significant given the nature of this crisis.
And why particularly did this develop in Guadeloupe? It reminds us a lot of the struggle that occurred in Mexico, the strike of the teachers there. What's a particular reason why this island became a leader in the struggle?
Well, number one, the General Union, General Guadeloupean Trade Union, has been a very strong militant union throughout most of its history. It's been a very active in international solidarity. They played a pretty significant role here in New Orleans in the tribunal that we held in August and September of 2007, which was looking and investigating into the various human rights abuses of the United States government. So, you know, they have a very internationalist outlook as part of their foundation. And the leadership that they gave to the struggle there, I think, you know, that's kind of a fundamental thing. But the material conditions which led to it, you know, the Guadeloupe as a French overseas possession, it is its economy is regulated in euros. It doesn't have its own currency. And folks get paid in euros. And with the kind of escalating prices, particularly around food starting in 2007, then in rents and in oil and gas, the living conditions of the majority of people deteriorated quickly. In the militant tradition and history of the UGTG, you know, they stepped forward, they built a broad coalition of over 49 different unions and community organizations and popular organizations on the island. And you know, they pressed, like I said, beginning in December, and tried to kind of meet some basic standards with the government, some basic compromises. When that wasn't met, they did what I would say they had to do, you know, to restore some dignity to their lives and some balance in the equation of where the economy stands on the global scale, and really the government impress, you know, the private enterprises on the island, you know, for some justice. And they won, but like I said, it's an ongoing struggle, and people should be very much aware.
Very quickly, Kale Kuno, there were massive protests in the streets earlier this month in France, and the biggest demonstration since Sarkozy's election. And then next week, the G20 is going to be meeting. Where do you think the significance of the Guadeloupe protest and victory fits into, and can it have any bearing on G20 and its blowback to France?
I think it will have a major impact, Amy. You know, workers all over Europe that I'm in contact with are using as the kind of the standard bearer. And I think with the earlier victory in Bolivia, with the constitutional referendum, and also the victory that happened in Venezuela, this is one of the key early victories in this crisis I think people all over the world are looking to as an example.
Kale Kuno, thanks so much for being with us. National organizer for the Malcolm X grassroots movement, organizer with the U.S. Solidarity effort with the struggle of the workers and people of Guadeloupe. He was actually speaking to us by video stream from New Orleans. As we turn now to a major crisis, the crisis of newspapers in this country. Juan?
Well, the New York Times and Washington Post have become the latest newspapers to announce plans to downsize their staffs. On Thursday, the New York Times company said it will lay off 100 people, about 5% of its staff. In addition, the Times is temporarily cutting the pay of its non-union workers by 5% in return for 10 days leave. The layoffs and salary cuts will affect employees at both the New York Times and Boston Globe. Meanwhile, the Washington Post has announced it is offering employees another round of early retirement packages or buyouts. Washington Post publisher Catherine Weymouth said the buyouts will, quote, allow us to reduce costs and gain efficiency while we continue to restructure for the future.
As papers across the country continue to fold or downsize, policy officials and experts are contemplating a series of proposals to help newspapers stay afloat. On Capitol Hill, Democratic Senator Benjamin Cardin of Maryland has introduced the Newspaper Revitalization Act. He wants to make it easier for newspapers to become nonprofit publications. Meanwhile, two longtime media activists from the group Free Press have proposed a bold solution, a government intervention to save American journalism. In an article in The Nation magazine, Robert McChesney and John Nichols propose a multi-part journalism economic stimulus package. They call for all Americans to receive an annual tax credit for the first $200 they spend on daily newspapers, free postage for many periodicals, government funding for high school and college journalism projects, and a large expansion of funding for public and community broadcasting. To talk more about this, we're joined by Bob McChesney from Madison, Wisconsin, co-founder of the media advocacy group Free Press and a professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Bob, lay out the plan.
Well, the plan simply is this. The commercial system of journalism, which has dominated in the United States for the past 150 years, is collapsing. It's disintegrating. And we're really left as a society with a basic option. Are we going to have journalism or not? If we're going to simply sit around and hope that the business community, Wall Street and Madison Avenue, are going to come up with a way to rescue it and give us the sort of journalism we need, we're not going to get there. It's pretty clear that's not going to happen. And that means we're going to have to turn to enlightened policymakers, making direct and indirect government subsidies to give us the resources to do journalism. And you already did a great job, Amy, of outlining the key elements of what we see as an emergency stimulus plan. And as by emergency stimulus, we mean something that will get us through the crisis so we can have time, buy time, to come up with a coherent plan that we can eventually have multiple newsrooms of well-paid, quality journalists covering their communities across the country that will segue into the digital era.
And Bob, the particular part of the plan that would call for the funding of journalism programs in high school and colleges, how might that work?
Well, we haven't done the details. We just wanted to throw out the idea. One of the great problems of journalism in the United States in the past three decades has been the decreasing involvement of young people. The average age of newspapers, the average age of viewers of television news programs seems to almost go up a year every year. And part of the problem, I think, is that we've seen a real cutback in school newspapers and radio stations in the last three decades with the cutbacks in the public sector. And kids aren't doing journalism as much anymore. If you don't do it, you don't really appreciate it. You get involved in it. So we think one thing we ought to do is make sure every high school, every middle school, every college has a good, solid, adequate funding base to do a newspaper and also to do a radio station. The more kids get involved in creating journalism, the more they're going to appreciate the good stuff.
Bob McChesney, we're going to break, and then we're going to come back to you. He's in Madison, Wisconsin, co-founder of FreePress.net. After we speak with Bob, we'll be going to FreePress.org. Not related at all, but that's about the 30th anniversary of the meltdown at Three Mile Island. Bob McChesney is professor at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. His article, The Death and Life of Great American Newspapers. Stay with us. Lightbulb Overkill by Blaine and Stephen. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Bob McChesney is our guest, co-founder of FreePress.net, professor at University of Illinois. Juan, as we're laying out Bob's plan to save the American newspapers, thinking about your forthcoming book and how you chronicle the history of newspapers in this country.
Right. Well, Bob, I wanted to ask you about that because you mentioned the subsidy plan that you saw these credits helping also, or the plan by getting free postal delivery. I think most Americans are not aware, as you have pointed out in many of your books, about the importance of the post office in allowing the development of this rich newspaper tradition that we have in this country. But now we're hearing the post office is claiming that it's virtually bankrupt, that it has to keep raising prices and reducing service. So how would this impact, since you're calling for free delivery of newspapers?
Well, it would mean that the post office would return to its roots, in effect. You know, as you pointed out, Juan, the post office began in the United States primarily as a distribution arm for American newspapers. In the 1830s, 90% of the traffic of the U.S. post office was newspapers and magazines. That was its basic job. Within cities, people got their newspapers by post, and the U.S. government heavily subsidized it. The newspapers paid a very small fraction of the actual cost of distributing their wares, such that at one point, only 2 or 3% of the revenues the post office came from newspapers, but it was 90% of the traffic. That's a pretty large subsidy. And we've got to return to that point today. We've got to basically say to the post office that in the near term, any publication that has less than 20% advertising, so it's primarily content-driven, it gets free postage. It gets complete free subsidy. That's going to keep alive a whole raft of publications that are struggling now with very onerous cost on them. And I want to point out on all these subsidies, because I'm not trying to keep alive old media. I'm not trying to keep alive dying media at the expense of new media and digital media. The condition of all these subsidies for student papers, for daily newspapers, for any publications get a postal subsidies, for community and public broadcasting, is everything that's done with these subsidies instantly goes online, is made free and accessible to everyone in the world who has access to it. So what we're really doing is creating a rich vein of quality material that's available to everyone for the digital world, for the blogosphere to work with. So we should view it really as a step forward, not as trying to hold on to the dying industry.
Bob McChesney, I also wanted to ask you about Senator Benjamin Cardin's proposed Newspaper Revitalization Act. This is part of what the Maryland Democrat had to say from the floor of the Senate earlier this week.
As local papers are closing, we're losing a valuable tradition in America, critically important to our communities, critically important to our democracy. So the legislation that I am following today, the Newspaper Revitalization Act, offers an opportunity to save our local papers. It allows them to be nonprofits, to operate like we do in many of the other media areas, such as public radio, public television, to allow for the opportunity for nonprofits to operate our local community papers. Now, this is not going to be an option of it that a lot of papers will choose. They want to make profit. They want to do their commercial. They want to make endorsements of candidates. But for some papers, it will allow us to save local newspapers. The restriction on going nonprofit would be that you could not endorse candidates. You can certainly report on elections.
Maryland Democratic Senator Cardin. Robert McChesney, your response to his proposal. He's introducing the Newspaper Revitalization Act.
Well, I think it's a historic moment, and I'm honored and delighted to see that Senator Cardin has done this. And I think what it points to, like my article too, Amy and Juan, is that we're in this historic crisis. I mean, a year ago, if I'd written this article or Senator Cardin had introduced that legislation, we would have been put in the funny farm. We'd have been dismissed as lunatics for even proposing it. I think 6 months or a year from now, this is going to look like very staid thinking, the way this crisis is going. Because as Senator Cardin points out, in community after community, we don't have any journalists left anymore. You know, in our system of governance can't work if people don't know anything about their community. It simply collapses, and that means the rule of law collapses, civil liberty collapses. I think that Senator Cardin's plan is a good start. It's part of the solution. It's not the entire solution, but I love the idea that people in Capitol Hill are waking up to this crisis and understand that doing nothing is not an option if we want to have a constitutional form of government.
Bob McChesney, we want to thank you very much for being with us, co-founder of Free Press, professor at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. His article, The Death and Life of Great American Newspapers, appearing in The Nation magazine. I'm looking forward to coming to Madison, Wisconsin at the beginning of May, the end of April, for the 100th anniversary of the Progressive magazine. It should be quite a remarkable celebration, beginning with a concert with Ani DeFranco and Dar Williams and others. And beginning that tour this weekend, our Standing Up to the Madness tour around the country, looking at conditions around the country. I'll be in Seattle on Sunday and Olympia, Washington, celebrating community media as we go, like Chaos Radio in Olympia, Washington, on Monday to Washington, D.C., and then we'll be going to Cambridge and to Amherst, to across Montana in Tennessee. We'll be celebrating WETS, a wonderful community public radio station there. We'll be going through Florida. We'll be going to Kansas City. We'll be coming to Minneapolis and many places. Just check our website at democracynow.org. We'll also be going throughout Ohio, to the University of Ohio. We'll be going to Columbus. And, Juan, that's where we're going right now to talk to our next guest.
Yes. Well, 30 years ago this Saturday, the Three Mile Island nuclear reactor in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, malfunctioned, sparking a meltdown that resulted in the release of radioactivity. It was the worst nuclear accident in U.S. history. In the pre-dawn hours of March 28, 1979, the cooling system of Three Mile Island's Unit 2 reactor malfunctioned, causing temperatures inside to skyrocket. Without water to cool them, more than half of the reactor's 36,000 nuclear fuel rods ruptured. Lieutenant Governor William Scranton first appeared on local TV and told residents there was no need to evacuate, but advised all citizens within 10 miles of the plant to stay indoors with their windows closed. Pennsylvania Governor Richard Thornburgh then evacuated pregnant women and small children living within 5 miles of the plant. Some estimate that well over 100,000 people fled Harrisburg and the surrounding areas. The evening of March 28, 1979, famed news anchor Walter Cronkite opened his nightly newscast on CBS by calling the disaster, quote, the first step in a nuclear nightmare. For the next 4 days, the nation and the world feared a full-scale meltdown would follow. This is an excerpt of Cronkite's broadcast on March 30th.
Good evening. The world has never known a day quite like today. It faced the considerable uncertainties and dangers of the worst nuclear power plant accident of the atomic age. And the horror tonight is that it could get much worse. It is not an atomic explosion that is feared. The experts say that is impossible. But the specter was raised of perhaps the next most serious kind of nuclear catastrophe, a massive release of radioactivity. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission cited that possibility with an announcement that, while it is not likely, the potential is there for the ultimate risk of a meltdown at the Three Mile Island atomic power plant outside Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
The accident at Three Mile Island fueled the nuclear debate in this country that continues to rage to this day. We're joined now by Democracy Now! Video stream by anti-nuclear activist and editor of NukeFree.org, Harvey Wasserman. Harvey, welcome to Democracy Now! On this eve of the 30th anniversary of Three Mile Island, what do you think it's most important for people to understand? There are some people listening right now who weren't even born in 1979.
What's important to understand is that people were killed in this accident. The nuclear industry continues to spread the lie that no one was harmed. In fact, nobody knows how much radiation escaped from Three Mile Island. Nobody knows where it went, and nobody knows what the impact was. I went into the central Pennsylvania area a year after the accident, and I conducted dozens of interviews with people who were clearly harmed by the radiation from the accident. There were cancers, leukemias, birth defects, stillbirths, hair loss, unexplained lesions, rashes. It was like being in the middle of a post-Hiroshima nightmare. And the reality is that the nuclear industry continues to deny that anyone was harmed, and all the serious indicators show that, in fact, people were harmed. There's a 2,400-person, or family, rather, class-action lawsuit that was filed in the 1980s that's still pending. The federal court system will not allow the people of central Pennsylvania to have an official hearing on the health impacts of this accident. And yet the industry, which wants to build new reactors, continues to spread the lie that no one was killed at Three Mile Island. It's utterly false.
Harvey, I was a young reporter, actually, at the Philadelphia Daily News in 1979 when the accident occurred. And I remember vividly the debates in the newsroom among the reporters as to whether they would want to go and cover the, because they had to travel to Three Mile Island, which was about a couple of hours' drive away. And the thing that struck me most was the lesson I learned. The greatest lesson I learned is that in major accidents, crises like this, you cannot depend on government officials to tell you the truth, because they kept changing the story day after day as to the nature of the release. And as you say, there's still not a clear sense of what the extent of the release was. What has been the continuing health effects on those on the communities closest to the accident, as far as you can tell?
Well, in fact, there's just been two new studies released in Harrisburg this week. One indicates that as much as 100 times more radiation escaped than the government and the industry have been willing to admit. And the other is that these statistics clearly show ongoing problems of cancer, leukemia, other radiation-related diseases. The fact of the matter is that the country, this is the best known, the most infamous industrial accident in U.S. history, and yet the industry and the government refused to get to the bottom of the situation. You should count yourself lucky that you didn't go there. Many journalists who did go to central Pennsylvania suffered significant harm. The radiation releases were very, very significant. And in fact, Walter Cronkite was wrong. The expert said there was no a possibility of an explosion. There was a possibility of an explosion because there was a hydrogen bubble inside the reactor. So the accident at Three Mile Island is ongoing. We will never have closure until the people who sued the central Pennsylvanians, the 2,400 families, get a day in court. The federal courts still say that not enough radiation was released to cause any harm, but they don't know how much radiation was released. In fact, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has admitted they don't know how much radiation was released, and they certainly don't know where it went. And every indication is that the health damage was significant and the people were killed at Three Mile Island.
Harvey Wasserman, we last had you on I'm looking at our website, February 5th, 2009. We had you on to talk about the coalition of environmental groups that were calling on senators to remove a controversial provision from the $900 billion stimulus bill that could lead to the construction of a new generation of nuclear power plants. That actually was taken out. What happened?
We won that three separate times. Three times the industry has come in demanding a $50 billion advance bailout, a blank check from the taxpayers to fund new nuclear plants. And we beat them with the help of Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid three times. But there's still $18.5 billion left over from the Bush administration and the industry to do loan guarantees. And the industry is going to come in again and again. After all these years, the nuclear power industry cannot get private financing for to build new nuclear plants. They cannot get private insurance to guarantee against an accident like Three Mile Island. And then now that the Yucca Mountain waste dump has essentially been canceled, there, after a half century, there is no place for the high-level nuclear radioactive waste to go from nuclear power plants. It's a catastrophe, and yet this industry continues to push itself and to claim a nuclear renaissance. What they're now doing is they've gone into states like Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas, demanding that ratepayers pay for new reactors before they're even built. And you know, so this is an ongoing struggle, and at the heart of it is what happened at Three Mile Island and the continued denial of this industry of what really happened, which is massive radiation releases and death and other harm to people in the area and, of course, to the local animals.
Harvey Wasserman, what does President Obama's support for nuclear power actually mean? And also, you mentioned Georgia, the Georgia Public Service Commission approved earlier this month two additional nuclear reactors for Georgia Power, which is this the first time nuclear power plants will be built in some 30 years?
Yes, and well, we think we're going to stop them. As I said, we've stopped the $50 billion. I want to mention that the reactor containment at Three Mile Island was actually thicker than most others because citizen action prior to the construction of the plant demanded a thicker containment because the Three Mile Island Unit 2 is right in the flight path of the Harrisburg Airport. Had that not happened, we might well have had an explosion at Three Mile Island. And today, we are continuing to fight these new reactors. I think ultimately we can stop them, but it requires full information to the general public. People have to know what really happened to Three Mile Island and have to understand that we have stopped the nuclear industry significantly over the past 30 or 40 years of activism. In 1974, Richard Nixon said there'd be 1,000 nuclear plants in the year 2000, and we've kept it under 120. Way too many still. There are 104 reactors now operating in the United States, but every one of them could be melting as we do this interview. And there's absolutely no place in the future for nuclear power. The Obama administration has got to come to its senses and stop this discussion of building new reactors, because it
Harvey
makes
Wasserman,
no sense.
Thank you very much for joining us. He's with freepress.org, not to be confused with Bob McChesney's freepress.net. Special thanks to the documentary Containment, Life After Three Mile Island. We also want to thank the filmmakers of Black Wave, the legacy of the Exxon Valdez, in our coverage this week of the 20th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And you can go to our website for more information. You can also go to blackwavethefilm.com. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Birx, Rufo Dokuduzar, Amate, Angelique Comet, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Massoud, Robbie Caron. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.